Hi, I'm Kevin Barrett. I have 4 advanced degrees in literature. That means that when I was in the academy, I spent a lot of time looking for good writers. Today, I spend a lot of time looking for good voices of truth. And some of them also happen to be very good writers. One of those is today's guest, Lynn Dinh. Lynn Dinh was one of America's notable up-and-coming writers. He was, well, celebrated and sponsored by the Academy, by the Foundation-funded literature outfits. But then he started telling the truth about 9/11 and other red pill issues. And the next thing you know, he was an unperson. Well, he's not an unperson here at Truth Jihad Radio. He's the kind of guy that I like to talk to. And if you like to listen to these conversations, please do go to truthjihad.com. For $4 a month, you can get early access and free downloads, plus the inner satisfaction of supporting great alternative radio. Once again, the website is truthjihad.com. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the all-out Truth Jihad, that is, the struggle for truth. A little justice wouldn't hurt either, but we're mostly interested in exposing the things that the corporate-controlled mainstream doesn't want to talk about, and also, I guess, some of the liberal identity politics hypocrites don't want to talk about certain things either, and that's partly what we're talking about here today, so this is going to be totally politically incorrect. And hopefully my guest, Lynn Dinh, who I think is one of our most interesting writers, actually he's a writer-photographer, travels the world giving us some of the best commentaries you can find anywhere on the World Wide Web, is probably going to shock the usual suspects, the political correctness police. So if I suddenly disappear from cyberspace, if I am imploded and completely annihilated in terms of my online presence, you'll know that it was all Lynn's fault. So, hey, Lynn, welcome, and it's good to have you, man. How's it going?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me again. Yeah.
Yeah, good to have you back. I love your work. It's really good writing. You know, there's a lot of good information in the alternative media, but a lot of it isn't really, the writing isn't anything to write home about. But you're writing home really, really well from all these different places, like Cambodia recently and stuff. And it's really good commentary. It's vastly better writing than anything I'm seeing in the mainstream. And I guess since you started taking the red pill and you know, breaking down some of those taboos, it's been harder to have the people, the custodians of great writing, take notice of you.
Well, the better I write and the better I think, the fewer opportunities I have. So that's why I'm in Vietnam, you know.
Funny how that works.
There was really no place for me back in the USA. Simple as that.
Yeah. And I guess taking the red pill and telling the truth about things like 9/11 probably didn't help your chances in the corporate world.
Well, I mean, you went through the same thing. I mean, your academic career went down the tube, didn't it? Because of what you've been saying.
Pretty much, yeah. Any university in America that hired me now would be facing the possibility of a scandal and losing a lot of money. So that's not going to happen.
But, you know, I actually think we're in a better place because the university has just gone insane. I think it's just preposterous. It's so farcical now that I'm glad I'm not associated with any university, American universities.
Yeah, I kind of feel that way, too. You know, I used to actually be sort of proud to be in the academy. You know, I thought it was a bastion of free thinkers, and they were violating taboos. And I guess that's because I was a little bit of a sort of a brainwashed leftist. I hadn't thought my way out of certain boxes yet, but I thought my way out of more than a few. And, like, everybody I knew had ever met in the academy understood that JFK was probably killed by a coup d'etat, and most of them weren't really afraid to talk about it, although they weren't mostly going to devote their careers to it. But there was a lot of free thinking and breaking taboos. It seemed like that was good. And then somehow that's all become bad, and they've really turned into complete sheep. And the one thing that makes them think that they're big political heroes is saying, you know, standing up for the rights of the multiply, doubly transgendered people who have a list of long pronouns that you have to memorize to refer to them. And that's their radicalism. Yeah. And, you know, that doesn't impress me that much.
I mean, there are so many taboos now that is, it's so paradoxical that, the university is the least, intellectually free, place in the United States. I mean, you're more likely to hear, to encounter free thinking in a low class bar than at a university, you know, and clearer thinking, better insights at any dive bar than an American university. I mean, just about everything that comes out of American university now is a lie and is a distortion of the truth. And, you know, I suspect that most of these people, well, maybe half of them actually know that they are, complicit in these lies and these distortions, that they know that they're lying, you know, but they don't have a choice because they have to watch, their own ass, you know, they have to protect their own career, their little slots in the system. And it's unfortunate because, yeah, I mean, these kids are paying good money to be brainwashed by hypocrites.
It sure seems that way. And they're sure losing a lot of credibility by going along with the BS. I'm sure there's a lot of truth that is still there in the academy, especially over in the sciences and mathematics department, because especially something like mathematics is not that politicized, and science can be somewhat politicized, but some of the basic facts about it are probably still there. But the further you get into things that can possibly be politicized, the more likely that something's being covered up or the whole field is being distorted. Just for one example, Lynn, you know, I used to play basketball with a bunch of guys from the biological sciences side of things at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And it was a lot of fun. And not just guys. There were a couple of women. There was one woman there who could kick my butt at basketball. She's like 6'5" and quite the basketball star. But these people in private conversations, you know, we got into our respective academic fields, and they told me that in the biological sciences side of things, they've discovered really massive differences between the male brain and the female brain, and that, you know, this, you know, the anthropology that tells us that in all cultures, you know, the men and women have always had totally different spheres of activity and, you know, different ways of life. They hang around with their own gender. They do very, very strongly sex segregated tasks. Men do this, women do that, whether it was hunting on one side and gathering in the other back in the day, which is the day that created humanity as we now know it, or whether it's, you know, what has happened since then in so-called civilization with agriculture. There are just massive gender differences. Gender is a fact. It's not just the genitalia, which is what you wrote about in your recent column, but it's the mind and the way of perceiving the world. And personally, I don't find this threatening. I think it's great. I love having a wife who's actually a woman, who's in so many ways a completely different species from me, who sees the world utterly and completely differently from the way I do. But I can kind of get some of that, you know, intuitively by, you know, absorbing by osmosis her genius in areas that I'm a complete moron. And then, you know, I admit I'm a little smarter in certain ways than she is. And, you know, some of those spatial tasks and logical spatial tasks or whatever, I think I'm a little better than her at. And so what? I mean, is that evil and bigoted to face that reality and enjoy it? I mean, it's crazy. But these people, like, just saying this is going to get me, you know, lynched and witch hunted if I walk into the wrong crowd. So, yeah, it's just one example, but there could be many.
Well, I mean, if you have a daughter who's a tomboy or a son who's gay or whatever, you know, I mean, you know, we make allowances for these variations, you know, but generally speaking, men and women are very different. But, you know, some men are womenish and some women are, you know, mannish, whatever, you know. And, you know, I don't find that there is tremendous discrimination in the United States, particularly against gay people, transsexual people. I mean, it should not be such a central issue, you know. I mean, I don't know why it's so crucial right now when there are so many threats to the country, and you know, but the focus of the country is almost totally devoted to these transsexual phenomena, which is I find preposterous. But you know, when you find the mainstream media pushing these transsexual stars, then you know they're up to something, you know, because if the mainstream media is behind any is endorsing anything, then you know that they are you being manipulated. When the Occupy movement happened, I remember Time Magazine gave the Man of the Year to the protester, You know, that showed me that they were not threatened by the Occupy protests. I'm not saying the Occupy protesters were illegitimate, but if Time Magazine could give it a pat on the head, then I knew that they had neutralized it, that they had, you know, they had castrated it, you know, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I think giving them that pat on the head was actually part of the process of neutralizing them. You know, I think there were a lot of carrots and a lot of sticks, you know, police nightsticks in some cases, that were used to keep that movement tamed and under control. But yeah, you know, if I were a paranoid conspiracy theorist, which is, of course, what certain sources will tell you that I am, I would say, you know, this whole identity politics thing might very well have been invented by people like the Koch brothers or other big right-wing fundraising types long ago. And they, you know, these guys might have looked at the left wing and said, you know, this left wing is kind of getting stronger and they want to redistribute more and more of our property. Right. By the late 1950s, the top bracket of the income tax here in the U.S. was, what, 90% or something like that. So rich people were actually having to donate some of their ill-gotten gains to the common good. And it looked like that process could go even further. And probably the people who didn't want that to happen would have been willing to put vast sums of money into funding some sort of brainwashing PR program to make the left look bad. And so my conspiracy theory here would be that this identity politics thing was funded by those people. And well, it turns out that actually feminism was heavily funded by the Rockefellers and others of their ilk. And, you know, we heard from Nick Rockefeller that supposedly they did that in order to get the women out of the homes and into the workforce where they could be controlled and taxed and regulated. But I think that possibly some of the explanation for this is that, yeah, you can get grants by focusing on this stuff. You can do transgender queer studies and get grants from the equivalent of the Rockefellers. And so I think they're trying to make the left look like a bunch of Looney Tunes to the average American, which means that the average American is never going to vote for the side that wants to redistribute the property of the billionaires. That would be my paranoid conspiracy theory.
Yes, I mean, makes sense to me. And also, it emasculates the intellectual class. You know, the university is very feminized now. You know, these men are so attacked and, you know, are so demonized that they, you know, they don't, you know, they're very defensive. So that's one way to neutralize a potential, group of people who could, you know, go after you. So, you know, they really castrated the men, literally. So, and like you say, you know, and, but the working class, the regular people see the absurdity of this and they enrage. So, you know, it's fragmentation of society. Identity politics is a way to fragment society so they can, basically, make slaves of us all.
Well, if you think about why they might want to castrate the men or intellectually castrate the sort of intellectual class of men, you know, they can think of a number of reasons why that could be useful, but sort of, you know, if you really zoom back and look at the situation sort of from, you know, the maximum distance, you know, you're some alien anthropologist looking down at Earth, say, why would they be doing this? Well, it could be because that, you know, male aggression fueled by testosterone, and that was, I think the average male testosterone level is, what, 30 times higher than the average female level, and then it's even, you know, it's especially high during adolescence and young manhood. And that's always been a social problem. Anthropologists tell us in every culture, the real number one problem is, what do you do with all those young men? You know, they haven't been fully acculturated yet. You know, unlike all other animals, humans take decades to really get acculturated. You know, they're totally helpless for several years. And then they're still pretty darn helpless, really, and still learning the ropes for a long time after that. And so you get this very toxic, potent combination of testosterone-addled, super-aggressive young men, and how are they, you know, I mean, they're basically being driven by their hormones to, you know, rape and pillage, and they don't have the kind of skills to step back from that and kind of control themselves, or they're slowly developing those skills. So every society has ways of dealing with this. Some African societies, you know, take them out in the bush and have a big initiation ceremony, scare the crap out of them, and then, you know, then circumcise them or whatever, you know, ritually mutilate them and, induct them into manhood. And the terror from that sort of freezes them into manhood. And, you know, in Islam, we have something a little bit like that, where boys of a certain age undergo that kind of coming of age ritual with circumcision. Which may or may not be such a good thing and may or may not be Quranic and authentically Islamic, but that's another issue. In any case, cultures have always had to figure out what to do with these testosterone-addled young men. And because testosterone drives aggression, and aggression does lead people to aggressively pursue their own interests, which can often be very detrimental to social stability. So imagine that you're in charge of a very complex, ever more technological society, which is creating a world that's more and more unsuitable for a natural human being, the human being that evolved in a hunting-gathering situation, to inhabit. How are you going to try to keep forcing these humans who are really suited for freedom? They're suited for wandering around and spending most of their time, you know, struggling for survival and basically enjoying that life. And how are you going to get them to enjoy being cooped up in a social prison, little plastic air-conditioned cubicles, clocking in and all that stuff, not pursuing their impulses at all, et cetera, et cetera? How do you do that? Well, the first thing you're going to have to do is take out the testosterone, because that's what's going to push the high testosterone types to cause trouble. So, you know, from that technocracy management viewpoint, it would make sense to sort of have to emasculate males. And I think they are doing that.
But
now,
Kevin, they only emasculating the thinking men.
The university attending males,
because you know the other types, they're encouraging the aggression, because the United States is actually a very it's actually a hyper-masculine society, because look at the sports, you know, that we indulge in, and look at the movies. Look, you know, I mean, we are a very violent society. So they are stoking that aggression with one half of the male population, and then castrating the other half, you know. So because as an empire, you need very aggressive men, you know, homicidal men, you know, insane, very frustrated, angry men. So they using that aggression with a half, you know, half of the male population, and the other half, the ones who might make a case against all of this madness, they are castrating. So these men don't even dare to talk anymore, you know, because they are being hounded and harassed and told to shut up because they're guilty of everything. But you know, Kevin, but who, you know, I think we talked about this before too. I mean, we know who are behind all this, you know. Maybe we can talk about that, you know, like, you know, the people who are purposely destroying the United States and many other societies as well. What, you know, who are these people, and why are they doing this?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. Well, first, let me just say, I think you're right about the encouraging the testosterone-fueled violence, at least a channeled version of it among the lower 50%. Absolutely right. And I think part of the way they do that is by channeling it so intensely. Like, you know, you can only get that violence out in, you know, in football or in the army. That just makes it even more bottled up and ready to explode. And then they try to make sure it explodes in the right place, which is, you know, in the mass murders that the army is basically all about. But yeah, who is behind this specifically? I mean, sure, I talk about the technocracy management level of things, but who are those people?
Well, I'm sure you've been following Ron Unz's series of articles on Jewish power. He's published, I think, five or six so far. And I think they're amazing because, I mean, they're synthesizing a lot of, you know, I mean, you and I and other people know about some of these, many of these facts already. But I think Unz is doing a masterful job of making, you know, of tying all the loose ends together and presenting a very succinct and readable case of what's wrong with Jewish power, you know. And we're not talking about Jewish ethnicity, you know. I'm not talking about Mr. Neff, you know, the deli owner. We're talking about a Jewish mindset that is very destructive to at least Americans, well, to Western civilization and whatever societies they touch. I mean, you know, of course, Muslim countries have been systematically destroyed by basically you know, by Jews. I mean, simple as that. You know, it's funny. You can barely say the word Jews without somebody, you know, cringing. You know, you can say blacks, Vietnamese, Chinese, but as soon as you say Jews, you know, the word Jews itself, you know, you can't even say that because, unless you're praising it, you know. So, you know, why are they doing this? You know, I mean, I have my ideas, but what do you think? Why are they systematically destroying what should be their society also?
Well, I think there's a very deeply rooted historical dimension to this. And I think Laurent Guyonneau does a fantastic job of elucidating this in his book From Yahweh to Zion, which I translated from French and published less than a year ago. So that's highly recommended if you want to find out the whole history of the downside of Jewish power. And, you know, to summarize that, you know, he has this cognitive elite among this group that became Jews, brainwashing their own tribe to be extremely hostile and fearful of other tribes, and telling them to go and smash the idols, that is the gods of the other tribes, and steal their stuff. And don't marry into them and always be very afraid of them. And that kind of set the tone. And ever since then, a Jewish cognitive elite has been, for fun and profit, been manipulating their own people, which of course manipulates the neighbors of those people as well, in service to this kind of split between the Jews and the non-Jews. And that cognitive elite is really the group that's causing the problem. And it's not the entire cognitive elite of the Jewish, you know, whatever, the tribe or the genome or however you want to call it, because there are a lot of people, very, very brilliant people, because this group has been, according to the analysis in From Yahweh to Zion, practicing a form of positive eugenics, that is the smartest young male from the Pale of Settlement in what's now Eastern Europe and Russia, would be sent west to study, not only to study with the top rabbinical authorities in what's now Germany or Spain or what have you, but to marry in to the families of the wealthiest elite business people and bankers and so on. And over the centuries, this process of teaching everybody to read, you know, the bar mitzvah is all about learning to read, and then selecting the most intellectually brilliant types and encouraging them to have tons and tons and tons of children with the daughters of the wealthy, has produced a group that, you know, Unz would tell you is, you know, what, 10 IQ points above the rest of the American whites and 20 verbal IQ points above the rest of the American whites. And so you extrapolate from that, and at the high end of the IQ curve, you're going to get a substantially disproportionate number of people from this group. And among those people, some of them, the not-so-tribal ones, are actually among our great free-thinking intellectuals, people like Spinoza and Unz himself, perhaps. They'll also be, however, among this cognitive elite, a certain number who are quite tribalistic or who choose to be tribalistic for their own interests. And those people are the ones who created a lot of the problems associated with this, you know, question of Jewish power. And so Zionism is the outgrowth of this situation, you know, this fanatical messianic nationalism. And it's not supported by traditional Jewish religion. What it is a bunch of atheists, ex-Jewish atheists, who managed to whip up messianic hysteria and fervor to convince people from that group to invade and occupy and commit genocide in occupied Palestine in service to this messianic, ultra-nationalistic sort of tribal ideal. And the cognitive elite profited quite handsomely from it, as did some people who were not from the Jewish group at all. That is, the British royalty and aristocracy and other managers of empire may very well have said, hey, getting these crazy messianic Jews over to Palestine is going to really be good. It's going to put a spear in the heart of the Muslim Middle East. They'll never be able to unite and rise up against us, this sort of thing. So I think that's kind of the general background. And then from the ideological background, we have to say that Zionism is a heresy. It's a, you know, it's not religious. It's a heretical offshoot of Judaism. Its real founder was Shabtai Zvi, whose career culminated in the year 1666, who said all the Jews should go back to Palestine and commit abominations. And this is going to force God to give us our Messiah, who will be, you know, the Jewish king who subjugates all the other tribes of Goyim. So that's my really short version of it. And since, you know, I'm saying this, I'm not writing this, so I'm not giving you all the references and so on. And so some people hearing this might think, wow, that Kevin Barrett, what a crazy anti-Semitic bigot. So I urge people to at least go and read From Yahweh to Zion by Laurent Guyoneau and check out his sources. He's a PhD historian, and do that before you judge me or throw me off my internet platforms.
Well, Kevin, in Unz's last article, he talked about the paradox of Jews present themselves as the biggest victims of the 20th century, when he said that they were the biggest mass murderers of the 20th century because of the involvement in all the communist movements in all these different countries. And so, I mean, that's a pretty bold, and I totally agree with it, you know, because I mean, I live in a place that still calls itself communist, but the ideology has pretty much faded away. So what's emphasized here now in Vietnam is nationalism. And I think during the war too, I mean, the Vietnamese on both sides, I should stress, South and North, the men who fought for Vietnam, they fought for for nationalist ideals. Because, I mean, no Vietnamese fought for communism or, say, for the United States. You know, I mean, you know, people don't die or, you know, kill for something like that. You know, for a foreign country or for an ideology, they, you know, all the Vietnamese men who fought on both sides thought they were fighting for Vietnam, and both sides stressed that. And right now, too, in Vietnam, you know, the nationalist credential, so to speak, of the Communist Party is stressed. You know, I'm not saying that I agree that it actually has nationalist credentials, but that's what is being emphasized, and not Marxism and not internationalism. And, you know, getting back to the Jewish mindset, because they did not have a country, of course they would you know extol a kind of idealism in international brotherhood, but I just don't think that actually works in real life. I mean, there's nothing wrong with nationalism. I mean, people should be attached to their nation, and by that I mean people who speak the same language, and I'm not talking about ethnicity, you know, but just at least the same language and occupying the same land. You know, instead of speaking of humanity as some kind of abstraction, I mean, we should talk about the Chinese, the Japanese, the Americans, the French, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with people identifying with their nation. And I think that's being weakened in the West for a very deliberate reason. And I think many of the Jews in the West are actually behind this. You know, they are ridiculing the very concept of nationalism, you know, of attachment to your nation. And that's why they are mocking the whole idea of even maintaining your borders, you know. And multiculturalism is another, a deliberate miscalculation, you know, that is being posed on all these nations, you know. So, I mean, multiculturalism just doesn't work. You know, you need a unifying culture, because without it, you don't have a nation. You know, and United States still has something like a unifying culture, but it's being weakened considerably. And sadly enough, what is holding it together is a kind of decadence, a kind of madness, the kind of degradation that is being pushed by the media, you know, by the Jewish media. I mean, to put it bluntly, you know, the kind of music that we listen to. I mean, we as Americans, the kind of music that is being pushed on Americans, the kind of movies, you know, is that's the common culture. And it's not a organic, healthy culture that is built over the centuries. It's something that is imposed from above. You know, it's a kind of poison that is being force-fed, you know, onto the American population. And I think it's been done very deliberately. And it's at this point, I'm not even sure there's anything left to salvage, because the madness has gone so far. And being in Vietnam, I can see the difference between a culture like Vietnam that is still coherent in, you know, although it's ruled right now by the Communist Party. Your average Vietnamese doesn't think that he's loyal to the, you know, the communists or the, you know, the party. he sees himself as being loyal to Vietnam, but to being Vietnamese, you know, and there's nothing apologetic about his conviction, about his love for his land and for people who are like him, you know, and that starts with the language. And in the West, that mindset has been so weakened. I taught for about 5 months in Germany, and the Germans, students that I taught were so apologetic about being German, and they didn't even know it. You know, they denied that they, you know, but they obviously were very guilt-ridden because of the Holocaust, you know, and that's another, great contribution, you know, that UNCTAD did recently, because I mean, many people have pointed out the absurdity of the official story of the Holocaust, but UNCTAD, you know, is making a very clear and succinct case that it just, much of it is just nonsense, you know, and that's the, one of the, it used to be one of the biggest taboos, isn't it, but, wasn't it, but I think people are being more open about their doubts about, you know,
the official version
of the Holocaust.
I think that debate is heating up on both sides. That is, that there are more people who are voicing doubts, and at the same time, the other side of it is stepping in to try to reinforce the official story and to punish those who are voicing the doubts. And so that's interesting. You know, it's kind of like, it's really heating up. You know, my friend Monica Schaefer, who used to be a Green Party activist, and then she discovered 9/11 truth. And then she discovered that the Zionists were a major player, if not the major player behind 9/11. And, from there, she started drifting into this, you know, more sort of strongly sort of, you know, revisionist, and, you know, anti-Jewish mindset, and read a lot of books and became convinced that, as that UNS article would suggest, that the Holocaust was, largely, you know, grossly exaggerated or fabricated. So she wrote that she, or rather she made a video about this, called "Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust." And on a visit to Germany last year, she was arrested, and she's been in maximum security prison since last December for making this video, playing a violin and sweetly apologizing to her mother. There's no hate or anything in the video, but she's still on trial. And according to Nick Kollerstrom, thousands of people have been imprisoned for questioning the Holocaust narrative. And the pushback against this questioning is getting stronger all the time, I think. Bonnie Faulkner's show was just taken down from Pacifica flagship station KPFA, or KPFK, I guess, in Berkeley, where she had had, actually she broadcast a talk by Ellen Zabrowski at a conference that I actually chaired. It was a cyber conference responding to the Left Forum, where we were banned. And Ellen Zabrowski, who himself is ethnically Jewish, said during his talk that he basically, you know, agrees with the Holocaust revisionists. And he said that quite, you know, strongly. So that was used as the primary excuse for not just canceling Bonnie's show, but taking down her entire history of her archives. And she has by far the best show on Pacifica. So that's an example of how the pushback against this is getting stronger and stronger all the time. So I think that battle is heating up. It's very interesting. To me, it's like with 9/11, it didn't take me more than a couple of days of looking into it to figure out that the official story was obviously false. You know, you've got Building 7. It takes 3 minutes to watch Building 7 come down and watch video of Larry Silverstein confessing to participating in demolishing his own building, for which he would then get $750 million by claiming that it was taken down somehow by terrorists who, you know, somehow, you know, by crashing into other buildings across the way, caused little wastebasket fires to start. You know, like, this is such a joke. So 9/11 is one thing. I'm officially a 9/11 heretic and a denier of the official story. I totally know that's not even a denier.
Kevin, you know, all these preposterous stories, all it takes is just common sense to debunk
them. Well, but the Holocaust, though, it's more complicated because, you know.
The Holocaust is a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, what does the word Holocaust even mean? It means burnt offering or sacrifice. Well, I can deny that whatever happened to the Jews under the Nazis, which does appear to have been a genocidal ethnic cleansing one way or another, I can certainly deny that that was a Holocaust in the sense of a sacrifice. But, you know, that to that extent, I would be denying it. But in terms of getting at the actual truth of precisely what was going on to not only with the Jewish population, but these other groups that the Nazis looked down on in various ways, and what happened in these various camps, which were certainly work camps, And we certainly did have Zyklon B used for delousing purposes. All sides admit that. But how many Jews were actually being killed? How many other people in those camps were being killed? For what reasons? Maybe not being able to work. How they were being killed? Were there actually any gas chambers or not? These kinds of questions. And then how many people, how many Jews were killed? You know, the total guesses range from 6 million plus down to less than 500,000. All of these questions are... It's an interesting debate, but it's also really complicated, and I can't come to a absolute certainty on this debate. You know, I would have to read quite a few more books. Like, I've read, wait, maybe, you know, five, seven that are directly relevant now, and Un says he's read, I guess 20, and so he's pretty convinced now that the story is bogus. So maybe I just need to read another 10 books. I don't know.
But I mean, for example, with the 9/11, incident, I used to live in Virginia, Northern Virginia, so I would take the bus to the Pentagon, you know, and get on the subway, the metro at the Pentagon station. So I know how high the Pentagon is. And when I heard that the plane hit it from the side, I just thought that's just nonsense.
Yeah,
I mean, you
don't
fly up the air and hit the plane from the side. I mean, why would you attempt that? Why don't, you know, it didn't hit it from an angle, hit it from the side. So that doesn't make any sense, you know. I mean, for a plane to to shave the ground to hit the Pentagon from the side, for me, that, you know, I say bullshit, you know. So I'm saying that, you know, what any detail that you look at, it just doesn't make sense.
Of course.
You know, or for example, with the Bin Laden supposed assassination, he have all these people sitting in the Situation Room, right? They're watching it live, like some kind of a movie, right? And yet they couldn't produce a single still, a single image. If you could see a whole, whatever, you know, 20 minutes of this excitement. Give me a still from what you saw. You know, they show nothing. There's not a hair. There's not a fingernail. There's nothing. So, you know, Bin Laden was definitely not killed that day. And I wrote about it immediately because I just said, doesn't make any sense. If they could see, you know, assassination live, then show me a visual evidence of it. There's nothing. So, you know, these stories are so farcical, most of the, and they're getting cruder and cruder because the population's getting dumber and dumber. You know, they believe anything now.
Yeah, it sure seems that way. And there are people apparently who actually are working to maintain these public myths, like Philip Zelikow, the sole author of the 9/11 Commission report, who wrote the whole thing in chapter outline before the commission had even started, is a self-described expert in the creation and maintenance of public myths. And one of the public myths he cites is the myth of the dastardly Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. And we now know, of course, that that was orchestrated by an American and British 8-point plan to force the Japanese to attack first, and that the Allies knew that that attack was coming, where it was coming, and they intentionally didn't notify the sailors or the commander, so they would get that 2,000 casualties to whip up the population into a fit of war hysteria. U.S. population had been 80-90% anti-entry into World War II before Pearl Harbor, and it was turned into a mind control event to incite war hysteria. And so Zelikow is proud of being one of these people who are specialists in creating and maintaining public myths like Pearl Harbor. Well, how did you create the public myth of Pearl Harbor? You had an 8-point plan to make sure that attack would happen, to manufacture the attack, essentially, and then use it for propaganda purposes. So clearly he's basically admitting that he and others around him manufactured the 9/11 event and used it for propaganda purposes. So there are these people who are shameless about basically admitting that this is their job to dupe us in these ways. And I suppose they justify this by, you know, relying on philosophies of people like Hobbes and Machiavelli, who, and of course Leo Strauss, the famous heir to those views, who say that the elite always has to fabricate reality, you know, they have to be projecting the shadows on the walls of Plato's cave to feed to all the chained up people and feed them a false reality, because these guys believe that basically, you know, we don't really know what's going on. So to keep a society coherent, you have to feed it these sacred narratives or myths. And so they just do that. That's their job. But it is way out of control now. And the internet has allowed us to see through a lot of these myths. And so I think that's one of the reasons, actually, for the instability in American culture. It's not just this decadence you talk about, but also more and more people are starting to wake up and notice that they've been brainwashed.
Yeah, but also, yes, there is. I'm not dismissing the segment of population who, you know, for example, I've discovered quite a bit through the internet. Otherwise, I would be in the dark too. But I think the internet, in the end, is is not helpful because it has made people unable to concentrate. You know, I can see that, you know, that even when something does make an impression, it's almost instantly erased or negated by the next impression, you know. So because this rush of just sensations and lights and flickers and whatever, you know, it has made it just like it doesn't matter, you know. It's just like, you know, people living in a stream of meaningless sensations. So there is no community anymore, because I mean, on a literal level, you don't have the local newspapers. You know, people don't read the newspapers anymore. I'm not saying the newspapers were that great to begin with, because they were propaganda sheets basically, but at least you knew what was happening in your town. Now, you know, everybody's in his own private internet. And so, you know, that the breakdown of community, the inability to think, to retain a thought or to follow through on a thought is, I think, too pervasive. You know, I mean, there is a minority who can still, investigate and maintain a coherent mind. But I think, especially the younger generation, I can see the harm that the internet has done. You know, so the breakdown of community is one of the result of the internet. And it's funny because living in Vietnam, I can see that it's happening here too, but it hasn't quite reached the same critical point that, you know, that has happened in the United States. So, people still live in the physical realm here. You know, they still interact with each other, physically. And that is something that, I myself, although I was always searching for that in the United States, I had a very hard time having a normal conversation with anybody. You know, I could go like a month without having a decent, thorough, or meaningful conversation, because there were always distractions, too many distractions. You know, and there was no public space, and even in a public space, there was too much noise, too much, media, interference. You know, and I think that was very deliberate. So in Vietnam, I see less of that. But, you know, of course, every society is heading in that direction, you know, of this sort of a scramble, a mental space. But the fact that Vietnam hasn't reached that point, you know, I'm hopeful that I'm hopeful that somehow a reversal can happen to save people from this sort of a mental breakdown, literally.
Yeah, I agree. And I wouldn't blame it just on the internet by itself, but I think that some of the changes over the past 10, 15 years on the internet have contributed to this, specifically the move to social media. I think the internet was better in like 2005 when I was doing 9/11 truth stuff on the internet, and there were still indie media outlets for each locality. So you could go to indie media in, you know, in my case, Madison, Wisconsin, or, you know, other people in San Francisco or what have you, and read these independent media stories about what was going on in their area. And we could put 9/11 truth stuff up there. And it was all, you know, curated to a certain extent and edited. So, you know, somebody was making sure that you go to the indie media site and everything is some kind of legitimate piece of information. And now you've got social media full of cat videos and, you know, very brief, twits and bleeps and farts or whatever. It's very much for the ADD generation. And then secondly, the rise of the so-called smartphones, which are really, dumb phones in the sense that they make people dumb. You know, if you carry around this little tiny screen all the time, staring at the little tiny screen, it does obviously turn you into an idiot. You know, I can't understand why anybody would ever do that. So I think the fact that that's how people are consuming stuff now, you know, you can't like read a novel on a smartphone. It's not designed for that. It's designed for all these little twits and bleeps and farts, going through your consciousness and giving you ADD. So I think those two changes, the social media and the little phones, that people carry around are the two, you know, single biggest destroyers of the intelligence of people of our age.
So what do you think is going to happen next, Kevin? I'm no longer in the United States, but you're still there and you have children. I mean, you know, are you hopeful for the future? Or?
Well, I wish I could be a little more hopeful, but, I essentially what gives me enough hope to carry on and be, reasonably optimistic is, my focus on the fact that we are not, just material beings living in space time and making history and making society, because a lot of that stuff is pretty grim. It's always going to be grim, and it's always been grim. I mean, sure, like you say, a small minority today can use our tools of publishing and so on that we have today intelligently. That's always been true. I mean, I think go to any point in history, and there's always been a pretty small minority that is really kind of seeing through things and able to really get a grasp on the big picture. But in terms of what life is really about, I think what life is really about is kind of spiritual development. Like, I mean, I'm a Muslim, right? So I kind of adhere to this picture of things painted by the Quran, which paints things in pretty stark and broad brush terms about how what we do in this life is preparing us for our fate in the next. And the consequences are very, very grave. And the difference between being, burning in the fire versus being in the garden beneath which rivers flow is pretty major. But even like the Tibetan Buddhists would tell you that when you die, you're taking the baggage with you that you accumulated in this life. And that's why they actually have specialists in helping usher the dying people into the next world. We'll tell you, those horrible thing, these hell world sensations that you're getting, these visions of demons and all of that. That's related to your own lusts and desires that you weren't able to get enough non-attachment to in this life. So don't worry, it's not objectively real. It's just coming from that part of you that wasn't able to resolve it in this life. And that way, they're able to actually supposedly help the souls of or consciousnesses of dying people get to a better place in the next world. So I think that is really what we're here for. And given that, it's all about responding the best we can to the test that we're being given in this life. And whatever the test is, just respond well to it. And in a sense, it doesn't really matter that much. I mean, the test can be pretty grim and nasty, but that's just an opportunity to respond better. That's the situation we're in. So with that worldview, I'm not devastated by the kind of horrible things going on around me in terms of history and society.
Well, but with the kind of country your children would grow up in, that's it looks very bleak right now, doesn't it? I mean, I think the best case scenario is for the United States to break up, so the central, the federal government, Washington D.C., that hell on earth can have less impact on people in, say, Idaho or Iowa or Wisconsin, where you are. So, if the country can break up, so it doesn't have the strength to inflict so much suffering everywhere, so these regions can sort of recover and redefine themselves. I think that's the best case scenario. I'm not hopeful that it can actually, that it will happen, because I think, the United States won't go down peacefully. I think it will, it might take the rest of the planet with it. But, I think, Americans need to regain their sense of, community, I mean, like the local, so they need to divorce themselves from, these places, New York and, Hollywood and, these distant places that have been dictating how their lives, are run. So, the United States, should break up, and, maybe it will happen. And, it would be best for all the other countries as well, that the United States won't be the major player that it is.
Well, that actually sounds okay to me. I actually agree that the USA as it is today is just too big, and that Washington, Hollywood, and New York are, not succeeding really in imposing their national culture on everybody they're trying, and the result is pretty horrible. So that would be a good idea. We do have some regional cultures left, and I just saw an analysis of this. I forget, was it the New York Times or one of these big mainstream outlets wrote a long article about some professor, actually it was by him, who talks about the very distinct regional identities of various parts of the USA. So that's a great idea. Of course, the people managing the USA aren't going to like that. But that leads to another observation I wanted to make a while back, which is that nationalism is, I think, the product of 19th century mass literacy. Benedict Anderson talks about this in his book, was it Imaginary, what was it called? Imagined Communities. And that's, you know, there's a good side and a bad side to this. But I think that identities, political identities, social identities, regional identities are probably better at smaller scales, certainly smaller scales than what we have here in the United States. And, you know, historically, people were citizens of their city state or of the city. If you go back and read the ancients or even the not so ancients, they're basically citizens of, you know, Florence, or Toledo or what have you. They're not, you know, Spaniards or Italians or whatever. That stuff was all invented in the 19th century as the conquering capital city, the soon to become capital city, conquered these regional cities and their provinces and then imposed the language of the capital city, which is why English in England is British English and French in what's called France today is Parisian French, not the French that they would have spoken in Bordeaux or Lyon or down in the south of France where the Cathar heretics used to be until they exterminated them. So this process of conquering, exterminating, and imposing a national language on everybody through mass education is a recent thing. That's only 19th century on. And I don't know if that's the best way to live. I actually kind of like the old Islamic model of having a sort of very loosely knit empire that taxes but quite lightly and doesn't really interfere in what people do and protects religious freedom and community freedom. And then you have cities, which each city has a different subculture running, totally running it with total autonomy. It's a Christian section in the Muslim empire where you can buy wine on the street, you know, because the Christians run that set part of the city. And so I don't think we need to have sort of ethnically pure, linguistically pure nations to have the kind of identities that you're advocating. You know, I think deeply rooted traditional identities can happen regionally, and then they can also happen even like in the same cities. So that's my beef with the nationalists.
Well, in Vietnam, there are actually 54 ethnic groups, you know, with different languages.
Yeah.
So it's not really, ethnically coherent even, but, you know, the so-called Vietnamese are still in the majority, and, you know, you know, whatever government is in control, they will insist on that dominance of Vietnamese culture. You know, I know it sounds, you know, people will cringe at that, but, you know, there's, you know, I know if I was a minority person in Vietnam, I would probably not find that very, annoying, if not oppressive, but, there is no other way, you know, because you need to maintain that myth of national unity to have a society, you know. And I know it's very problematic. I agree. And, you know, in Vietnam, I see all kinds of subtle divisions, you know, even, for example, my accent, you know, here. As soon as I open my mouth, you know.
Hello, Lynn? I think we've lost your transmission. Okay, I'll try to reconnect here. As soon as Lynn opens his mouth, suddenly somebody cuts him off. That's very suspicious. Well, let's see if I can bring him back. Okay, we got Lynn back. I think that was on my end, actually, where we dropped. Oh, yeah. So you were saying that people react to your accent in Vietnam.
Oh yeah, I was saying even among Vietnamese, there, you know, people notice these differences, regional differences, you know. They can tell, for example, that somebody's from the north, from the central, or from Saigon, or from the Mekong Delta, and that they make all kinds of observations, and they react, I'm sure, somewhat differently, you know, I'm saying even among Vietnamese, there are these differences. So nationalism, I agree, is always a kind of a fiction that is imposed, but I don't see another way to, you know, for example, all the wars that the Vietnamese have fought, that sense of that we belong together, you know, despite of our differences is what's, necessary, you know, and the language, you know, the national language, like you say, you know, like, in Europe, people were loyal to their cities and all that. But, yes, and there are variations within the Vietnamese language itself, from north to south and from regions to regions. But, Vietnamese nationalism actually, goes back, a couple thousand years, you know, because, there was, Vietnam got its independence from China 1,000 years ago, you know, but there were always, Chinese occupation. They saw that. So even before they got full independence, there were brief moments where they got independence. So the Vietnamese have always been a very rebellious tribe against Chinese rule. And there was actually a Ding dynasty, you know, almost 1,000 years ago. So, you know, for example, you know, when I'm here, I can feel that history, you know, that gravity, that, you know, because, you know, of my namesake, you know, like, you know, there you go.
That's a pretty cool history, actually.
The national consciousness is very deep here and very, you know, very severe here.
Right. Well, that's actually a pretty noble history, the way Vietnam has managed to fight and keep its independence over the centuries, and most recently against the French and then the Americans. So that's kind of something to be proud of. And I suppose all national groups have various types of things to be proud of and other things to be not so proud of. But, you know, we may have to save some of that discussion for another show, because we hit the end of the hour. So it's time to say thank you, Lin Dinh. I appreciate your incredible writing. The combination of the writing and the photos is just really great. It's fun to read your stuff. So your website is lindinphotos.blogspot.com. Is there anything else, or is that the one you're using?
Well, thanks for having me on, Kevin. Really
okay.
Appreciate it.
All right, great. Good to talk to you. Take care.
Okay.